It's The Wonky Show, where for our Easter special, we're looking back to our Secret Life of Students event in March. It's all coming up.
How did the quid I spent do? Where did my money go? How far did it go? Well, here's students who are spending 30, 40, 50, 60, 70,000 pounds into their education in our country over a period of just, let's say, a year.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and as I said at the top, for our Easter special, we're looking back to our Secret Life of Students event in March, where the best part of 500 friends from around the sector gathered to discuss a new vision for the student experience. The day kicked off with someone called Jim sharing stories about the student experience and what that might mean for higher education in the future. But back in September 1995, my dad dropped me at my student house at the University of the West of England on Sunday afternoon at 2:15pm. 3 hours later, I was in the student union bar pretending to like Guinness, talking to some posh students about gap years, building schools and interrailing. Eventually, it was my turn and I said, well, on my gap year, I travelled and worked. I travelled to Wolverhampton and worked in a shoe shop. Everyone laughed, but it was true. They were laughing at me. Less than 20 hours later, I was at my first lecture. Everyone seemed to know how to take notes. I didn't. A month later, my first field trip. Others had done field trips before. I hadn't, and I'd packed the wrong things. 6 weeks in, first assignment, no clue what was expected. The unwritten rules of university create deep gaps in experience and results. We all had the same induction, but not the same preparation. We all read guides on student budgeting, but we didn't have the same budgets. We all walked through the same doors. Some of us had maps, and some of us didn't. But if I was to search for a guide on or support for how to be a student today, I'd come up short. There's a myth in higher education that getting in means you're ready to succeed. What felt to me like a simple adjustment trouble was really deep inequalities in preparation, knowledge and confidence that shaped my whole experience. But yet 30 years on, today's students arrive with more diverse preparation than ever, different educational backgrounds, wider social diversity, more often than not recruited for potential, not polish. But meanwhile, universities have gotten more complex too. They're bigger and less personal, more expensive with higher stakes, higher expectations from family, friends, and glossy marketing. Universities spend loads of time defining what graduates should be like, what they should know and what they should be able to do when they finish. But we spend little time defining the skills and knowledge that allow students to navigate university successfully. We know what we want at the end, but we don't tell them what they need at the start. In the rest of that opening, I argued that student rights should be an important part of any vision for HE in the future, and former OFS Director for Access and Participation, Chris Millwood, now a Professor of Practice in Education Policy at the University of Birmingham, along with NUS President Amira Campbell, had a few things to say.
The notion of the resilience of the full-time model, albeit reflecting an environment in which it's enmeshed with work, with commuting, and indeed mature students studying full-time. So really thinking differently about what's actually happening for full-time study. The second was the notion of the extended middle age and the different life transitions and the sense in which, you know, university isn't a stepping off point or education isn't a stepping off point for something definitively different. There's a much more complex set of pathways now happening, which requires us in universities to think differently about that.
I think that the full-time model, and it's sort of going to touch on what Chris has said, but it's more about the learner journey, right? Because before 16, generally speaking, I guess education is sort of like a race, right? And there's some people that are running it really fast and arrive at the place that they're supposed to be by 16 ahead of time. And there's some people running behind, desperately catching up. And at 16 is sort of the cutoff mark for you to either have completed the race or not in education. And then after that point, you've got some options. You either sort of, and your institution that you're at, your school, are very clear to you about which options are the better options and which options are the less good options, right? It's the ideal option is that you go and do some A-levels, and then from A-levels, you go to university. And then when you're 21, you get a high paying job and well done. And that's fantastic. And maybe you spent a year out in France learning about the world, right? Or your options are sort of to do a BTEC, and the path after BTECs are actually less clear. Your institutions are less supported or motivated to try and get you onto a BTEC, even if it is the better thing for you. In the moment, we're looking at a world where potentially we're going to be discontinuing BTECs for all students who can't get on to A-levels. And then we've got sort of your level two, level three, a apprenticeships, and that's an option for you to sort of go into the labor world and get paid really, really poorly, but hopefully you'll have a great time. And then to leave out that, we've got the sort of newer thing, the T-levels, where you do 300 hours of unpaid labor. But it's really, really great because maybe you'll get on a higher apprenticeship where you're still paid crap all money. And so I think higher education has definitely still positioned itself within that scheme of sort of options to the wider public as the best option. The sort of full-time undergraduate degree is still considered to be the most guaranteed way at a great future in the UK. And I think that not only is there the sort of incentives for sort of our institutions to continue that full-time model, there is still a public belief that it is the best way to go, or that it is sort of the ideal only route to go. So I don't think there is really a student choice to get on to what you were saying. But then also, if we then look at sort of our widening participation goals or our access goals or et cetera, like sort of vision was, well, if we get a mass higher education, then everyone will benefit from that, et cetera, et cetera. But then we're still seeing that our most marginalized people aren't the ones doing A-levels and going to universities, right? And actually, if we discontinue BTECs, we're getting to a place where the idea of sort of studenthood is largely reserved for those who got the grades at GCSEs, which is informed by those same disparities. And so I wonder how much pushing or keeping on to and holding on to the full-time model is saying that studenthood remains to be reserved for a certain type of person, and that actually, if you aren't that type of person, then you must do a T-level or an apprenticeship, and your skill, or the only reason to uplift your skills, is for the purpose of the workforce.
Now, throughout the day, we heard stories from students about their experience and the implications for HE policy. Here's Surrey SU's President Liam White.
And I had to choose academic and social pressure, or developing and trying to improve my mental health, coursework, or paid work. I was running on a burnt out battery that never had the time to fully charge. Lecturers churning out recorded lectures of self-admitted diminishing quality. Overassessment that kept me constantly on the edge without actually doing anything to make me more employable. This wasn't what they promised me in those glossy brochures. This wasn't what I signed up for, and what indeed I was paying through the mouth for. And this isn't the experience that we deserve. But there were things that helped. I firmly believe that you get better decisions when students are in the room. It's students with the drive, with the passion, with the knowledge and expertise to make a difference. And it was student activism that built the support networks that saved me. The networks that continue to save students every day at university. Examples are COVID-era safety net policy, self-certified extenuating circumstances, student-led support services. These things only exist because students fought for them, because we demanded them, knowing that we deserved better. And when I'm invited to a stage like this and have the opportunity to look back, I find myself thanking my predecessors who fought for this experience. In a world where it feels like the majority of institutions don't recognize university beyond a transaction where you are paying to get a simple piece of paper at the end.
In the United Kingdom, I realized there are more individualistic perspectives, and shifting into this new lens was the hardest adjustment I had to make in 19 years of my life. I saw newspaper headlines every day about international students and immigration, visa, student fees. It felt like I was being sold a lie that I was actually not welcome. The realities of coming to the United Kingdom was a culture of hostility that had been shielded from something because of the lies I was provided by my agent. My first week of university, I was excited to see so many faces from all around the world. And as I approached them with a little bit of nervousness, I was met with resistance. For the first time, I was hyper aware of my race and my gender. The hardest thing I did was keep putting myself out there, and even when I didn't feel like I belong, that's when the Students' Union became my home. I became a course rep, I led the Women's Liberation Society and the Bollywood Society, and eventually I was elected as the Education Sabbatical Officer. Slowly, I started reclaiming my sense of belonging. You belong by doing things. But even then, I often felt like I had to work twice as hard just to prove that I deserve to be in the room. People assume that the United Kingdom is inclusive. It's promoted as a diverse and inclusive country. but my experience clearly tells a different story. People like to say that they're inclusive, but their behaviors don't replicate what they say. I've been told to my face that I'm incapable of leading because I'm an Indian woman. I've had my abilities questioned, my intelligence doubted at every step I took, and my voice dismissed often. And yet, without these experiences, I wouldn't have fully understood the systematic barriers that exist for people like me.
That second voice there from Mahita Parekh, who's the education officer at Middlesex Students' Union. On the theme of international students, I also sat down for a fireside chat with Sanam Arora, who's the founder and chairperson of the National Indian Students and Alumni Union UK, who was very concerned about honesty.
I think the number one thing is around employability. We've conducted a ton of research in the past. We know it from our daily lived experiences with Indian students that the number one reason majority of Indian students would consider studying abroad, certainly in the UK, is this expectation that there will be some employability outcomes. That doesn't necessarily 100% translate into I expect a job, but what it does mean is that I will become globally employable and I'll have the opportunity to secure meaningful work experience after I've completed studies. And that is why the graduate route, 2 to 3 year graduate route, is so important. Yeah. But in that regard, what is now happening, and in fact, we conducted a survey led by QS and UUK, where we found that, I think they surveyed about 10,000 recent international graduates from the UK, and it was found that only 3% of international graduates are actually finding jobs through their career services. 3%. Now, I know that this situation is not the most optimal, but 3% is pretty low. And that just sheds light on this entire question of return on investment. Like, when I put a pound into a mutual fund in the UK as a British taxpayer or as a British investor, I get a detailed, like, 30-page value for money report. Mandatorily, because the Financial Conduct Authority makes sure that I get that value for money report. How did the quid I spent do? Where did my money go? How far did it go? Well, here's students who are spending 30, 40, 50, 60, 70,000 pounds into their education in our country over a period of just, let's say, a year. They're right to expect certain metrics of ROI. And if one of those critical metrics is employability, and you're telling me only 3% are actually landing jobs through their career services, something is missing. So I think one, and this is really contributing to very bad optics for Indian prospective students who are thinking about study destinations, because studying is not equal to sitting in a classroom and listening. Studying is equal to gaining the opportunity also to gain meaningful work experience. Again, I insist, not equal to employment, but equal to employability, which includes real work experience. And so in that regard, employability is a major issue. And the lack of career service support. Now, I might get hated by a lot of career service people because I know they're spending all their time thinking about how they can improve things. And I'm sorry, but you asked me to be picking out the crunchy, honest things. That's one. What that is leading to is the second thing I want to talk about, which is the knock-on impacts of career services not meeting student expectations, is that you have left, right, and center random career coaches popping up on Instagram, charging thousands and thousands of pounds, you know, literally the most, I mean, in best case, basic information that ChatGPT can spurt out at you. In worst cases, literally scamming students, I'm sure, and we can bring many of these stories to life, but, you know, promising employability if you do this, if you enroll on this course worth £3,000 and 3-4K is like the average starting thing, and then you have to enroll 5 of your friends, almost like a affiliate marketing scheme in some ways. There's all sorts of really bad stuff going on Insta, completely uncontrolled, because fundamentally so many of the support services that surround higher education are unregulated.
Later we heard from a group of SU reps on what students want from their experience and the kind of changes they're seeking to make their vision a reality.
Read them out to you right now, because I'll go through each of them in turn. But basically, as you can see, our ambitions are very high, and all of them mentioned something along the lines of best in the world.
No pressure.
No pressure at all, no. Well, definitely more for the university executive board than it is to us anyway, which is something us student SABs really like to do. But as you can see, it's a lot about, I guess, taking what we have at Bath, and I think the SABs and the staff team, after going on several wonky trips, actually having engaged in conversation with different universities in the sector and the country and in other countries, we had the sincere conviction, and I'm aware that might not land well in a room full of different institutions, but we had the sincere conviction that we have the ingredients to have the best student life in the world. So we just asked ourselves, why are we not actually putting that in writing and asking the university to commit to fulfilling these like ambitions that we had as a student body? So these are the 6 core ambitions. I obviously don't have a lot of time to explain a lot of the like different reasoning that went into all of them, but what I'll do now is give you a whistle-stop tour of the 6 ambitions, give you a couple things that went into, I guess, drafting these ambitions, and then I'll just encourage you to read the full document document in your free time after. If you Google Together We Shape Tomorrow, the SU Vax. Yeah. Okay. You get the link. You can read it in more detail and see all the data and all the insight and the things that went into each of them. What essentially is our values, what we believe as student officers, or what we really believe as a union within that document. It ranges from things that students deal with in the daily. We talk about mental health. We talk about the education, the quality of the education, housing crisis, accommodation. We talk about everything that a student would possibly might expect the union to talk about within that document. And I think whilst we're talking about the future of the students, it's really vital. And I must emphasize that it's very basic need of students, that are very basic ask, that we want more clarity, we want more transparency, and we want more consistency. How do we actually ensure that is happening? Of course, as you guys have mentioned earlier, that unions are very much known to be very much about campaigning. We love that stuff. But when it comes to some long-term strategies, we're not always sure what our stance is, or where do we actually really stand when it comes to that stuff. And we hear from students all the time that we don't want one individual officer to represent the whole student body. Like, imagine if I was here as a president and we have 27 to 28,000 students in Salford, not everybody would feel like I'd be able to represent that person. I think that's very vital, because that's exactly the reason why we said, no, we need something that students can actually have something. They know what we really believe in. And I love to see how the culture is now changing, where students are becoming more aware, or they want to hold people accountable. They want to hold the university accountable. They want to hold the union accountable. If we are promising something to the students, we must ensure that we're delivering that. And whilst we're talking about that, whilst we're talking about students, I think this might not actually land very well in this room, but just be honest with yourselves for a second. How many times have you actually seen in an institution where students, where you were told we were going to do something, we're going to consult the students just as a text box exercise? Have you seen, heard, or anything? You don't actually talk about student experience, or you don't actually talk about what students want, or you don't always necessarily consult them. And that's not what students are asking for. This is really not it, because whilst they want to be consulted, they want to make sure they're consulted in a way where it's actually going to land an impact. It's actually going to make some change. And to be honest, in my year as a president, I've seen from unions, or I've seen from the institutions, where everybody talks about, we want to do this for the students. But when you ask them the question, have you actually spoken to anyone? Have you actually consulted a student? Are they like, no, we know it. How do we know it? You've not consulted anybody about it. And you yourself might have been out of education for what, 20 years, 30 years? So much can change in a year, never mind 20 to 30 years. But is this what we're doing? But why are we talking about students? How are we just assuming that this is what students want?
Gigi Alamo and Alvina Imran from Bath Students' Union and Salford Students' Union there. Now, after lunch, we heard from Abigail Harmer from the Equality and Human Rights Commission on disabled students.
Well, the incentive, I would say happy students, hopefully a better student experience, which leads to better student welfare, and hopefully better reviews of the institutions and fewer complaints. That would be nice. Also, I would say that by making reasonable adjustments easier to put in place, hopefully it would take a bit of a burden off staff, because they're not battling constantly to try and get the adjustments into place for their students. And then there are things like employability and students gaining valuable work experience, working alongside disabled colleagues, which hopefully will help them subsequently when they're in the world of work. In terms of sticks, the big one is obviously litigation. It's very expensive for institutions, it's stressful, it's reputationally damaging, and that's even before you lose your case. There are also internal university complaints processes, and then the OIA, or in Northern Ireland and Scotland, the Ombudsman. And then the OIA has their own annual statements, which are interesting to compare. And then from our point of view as the regulator of the Equality Act, the other big stick is we can take regulatory action. We don't do this very often, but again, if you wanted to have a look at our website later, there's some quite interesting things that we've done, not in the field of HE, with people like Pontins, the holiday parks, recently with McDonald's, which was in the news, I think, last week. And there's ongoing work with Department for Work and Pensions. So there is stuff that we can do. We have a range of legal powers, including the power to investigate institutions and organisations. And we can enter into agreements and action plans to kind of insist that institutions comply with the law. Going back to incentives for changing practice, there are so many more disabled students at university universities, and that has to be celebrated. The playing field should be as equal as possible to allow those students to achieve in the same way as their disabled peers. My view is the UK is a world leader in higher education, and we should be a world leader in promoting an equal access to higher education. We don't need to lose anything. We don't need to dumb anything down to make these adjustments. And a crucial point that I point out regularly is that this isn't new. This law has been enforced since 2010. It's been around a while. And I know from speaking to various university professionals that there's a lot of great work going on out there, whether that's going around mapping competence standards or ironing out pinch points in disabled students' journeys. And lots of institutions are taking a more universal approach to reasonable adjustments or designing courses so that adjustments aren't required because they're already suitable for everyone. And I really commend that. Some institutions are also giving their academic staff more autonomy to make their own decisions on reasonable adjustments within a reasonable framework. And that means that the disability service is free to focus on the most complex cases, which just makes sense to me. It's better for universities and for students, and it's a lot quicker. And means the most complicated cases are getting the tailored support. One thing I wanted to briefly mention, if you'll indulge me, is that I've come across an argument that if a disability service has recommended an adjustment and the university has failed to put that adjustment into place, then as well as being a failure to make reasonable adjustments, it's a breach of contract between the student and the university. I think that that's a completely false argument. It's going through the courts currently, but from my point of view, I don't care if it's a breach of contract or a breach of the Equality Act. It's still unlawful. Either way, it's not going to do you any good, and you'll be on the back of some kind of legal claim. So all in all, to me, it seems to come down to a culture change so that those with the most unlevel playing field starting out, our disabled students, can still achieve alongside their non-disabled peers.
Now, there's lots of aspirational chatter about the future of learning, but what happens when aspiration meets reality? That's what we looked at in a session with Sam Grogan, who's the PVC Education and Student Experience at Loughborough University, and Helen King, who's Director of Learning Innovation, Development and Skills at Bath Spa.
Fundamentally, I think, you know, to offer a world-class educational experience is really about enabling our students equity of opportunity to be challenged and to thrive and to succeed. Thank you. And that world-class experience really, if it is world-class, then it will show there's a coherency to an institutional endeavour in that respect. And so we see that understanding in action from an institutional perspective, and there's a consistency there in what it means to be challenged and what it means to thrive and what it means to succeed for the student and for the institution. And I guess zoning in on that student experience, if I zoom down, I think I'm going to take it in the order that we might navigate our student experience. So first of all is really how we might welcome students into our institutions. And I think fundamentally to that, to be world-class and to be excellent is to recognize and put the student at the centre. There's a lot of rhetoric around students at the centre. I'm not sure it's true. And I think being inclusive by design, we heard elements of it in the previous discussion, and adopting a stance of not being a deficit model, not come to us and we will make you like us. It's come to us and we will make you or help you be more you. And that recognises then the student definitions of success, and therefore the intelligences and the perspectives and the histories that they all bring with them from their own perspectives. And I think that put alongside those intelligences and behaviours and attitudes and aptitudes that they might acquire through the journey. So the first really is about fundamentally being inclusive by design and a non-deficit model. In terms of when they're here, they're in our institutions and they're travelling through their learning experience, I think being world-class really fosters a sense of belonging and community and extends the students' networks and challenges them. And I also think being world-class is also to acknowledge and sit with the discomfort of deep learning. Barriers are inherently uncomfortable to break through.
And wouldn't it be wonderful if we could find a silver bullet, that one approach that works for everyone? But as we've heard today, human brains are complex and diverse. Human beings have diverse and complex lives. And formal learning is just that one part of it. So as Debbie said, and as Sam started talking about, you know, there's just a whole range of aspects that we could explore. But I'm just going to touch on a small number of themes because I'm aware I've only got 5 minutes. So I think a world-class learning experience should be transparent. There should be a shared understanding of the expectations for learning, teaching, and assessment for all actors in the space. There shouldn't be hidden expectations for the teachers to know and the learners to find out. Students need guidance on how to make the most out of their time in different learning environments and guidance on approaches to independent study. Marking criteria should be explicit, clear, and adhered to. And this, as we've talked about earlier, this isn't about dumbing down or giving students the answers. This is about giving students a map to help them find them the best route. I'm going to use a running swimming analogy here, but I'm very aware I have niche leisure pursuits. So try to sort of find the right metaphor for you, the kind of journey traveling metaphor. In a trail running race, there may be some markers showing you where to go, but no one is going to do the running for you. A map is made available in advance, but you're also expected to have a copy en route. But sometimes you find yourself running with others and you help each other out. It's a guided solo adventure, but very often a collaborative endeavor. I think a world-class learning experience should also be creative. So creative in the sense of taking a thing, making meaning of it, and making it your own. As Sam was alluding to, it's not the transfer of knowledge into students' brains that they then regurgitate or retell in their assessments. Learning should be about meaningful context, problem solving, applying knowledge and skills, critically evaluating sources of information. Assessment is a really important part of this learning process. It's an opportunity to check, benchmark your progress, to try, fail, learn more, and learn better. And we need to think of assessment as learning. It's not a test or not just a test of learning. It's the creative output of our learning. It's where we take what we've learned and we create something new and authentic, whether it be a piece of art or an essay.
Of course, students' experience is often about the place. And in the afternoon, Susan Kenyon, Principal Lecturer in Politics at Canterbury Christchurch University, and Joel Dowson, who's Greater Manchester Students' Partnership Manager for students' unions across the region, they both had thoughts.
Yes, so the Greater Manchester Student Partnership has been kind of running in some form for kind of 7 or 8 years since Ambie Burnham, the Mayor of Greater Manchester, was first elected in 2017. And the idea behind it is to the five student unions in Greater Manchester working together on regional issues to make Greater Manchester the best place for students to live in the UK. Bath going for the world, we're just going for the UK. but we've kind of got the four kind of focus areas of what the mayoralty has power over. So transport, safety, mental health and housing are our kind of four key priorities that we work with. So it's not looking at those kind of hyper-local issues, as we mentioned earlier, in terms of bins, kind of classic town and gown, noise, cleaner complaints, but also not looking at those kind of national issues, kind of student finance, fees more generally. It's kind of those kind of regional issues that really affect students. And we're trying to, when we work with the mayor's office and the combined authority and the team, we meet with the mayor twice a year. And the kind of the board is made up of eight sabbatical officers from the five institutions that we work with. And of those eight officers, each two of them have a focus on one of the kind of key areas. So they can become experts in those areas, get to know it a little bit more. And then it kind of works that obviously staff have to hold the vision long term because the sabbatical officers move away, but the sabbatical officers can really drive the agenda for what is going to be talked about this in the year or two that they are a part of the Greater Manchester Student Partnership Board. We campaign on specific issues, but we're also looking at what the mayor is also trying to achieve in Greater Manchester. So the B Network has recently launched in Greater Manchester, which is the first kind of transport system outside of London, which is kind of fully integrated and fully operated again by the combined authority, by government. And we've seen some reduction in price for students, and there are some student products there, but we'd love to see more of a variety and a range of student products for sure. And then also kind of focusing on something called the Good Landlord Charter that the mayor is launching in May, which is a charter that landlords can sign up to go above and beyond the legal minimum required standards of a landlord. And they have to meet 21 criteria that fit into 7 areas of what a good landlord is. So safe and decent, of affordability, to name just 2. So we've really worked on committees and being a part of working groups and trying to remind the combined authority, especially in this Good Landlord Charter, that students are a really key stakeholder within this. And there is over 120,000 students living in the city region of Greater Manchester, all of them looking very different as well. And we recognise that massively. But how can students feed into what these key things are? So there has been a recognition of purpose-built student accommodation as specialist housing. So PBSA providers will have to go even further above and beyond what a kind of standard private landlord will offer if they sign up to the Good Landlord Charter. We'd love universities in Manchester and Greater Manchester to sign up to it. So if anyone's here from Greater Manchester, please do chat to me at the end as well about it. I'd love to tell you more about it. But we'd love to to see as many people signed up to that as well, to improve the life of students in Greater Manchester. But there are also kind of individual campaigns that we're looking at. We're looking at how can we improve the mental health of students, and safety is something we've talked about. We consulted heavily on the new police and crime plan for Greater Manchester as well. So we're trying to basically remind the Combined Authority in every way that students are a key stakeholder within this. And just like one example quickly, buses, which if we could talk about commuter students, buses a better for in Greater Manchester for those who live in Fallowfield, which is the heavy student area all around campus. That is the best way to get around. And there is a monthly and a termly bus ticket there that students can buy on that. There's not a single or a daily or anything more flexible, but there is at least something. Whereas if you're a commuter student living in Oldham, for example, a tram for a 28-day pass is £105 and it takes half as long as getting a bus. So you're definitely going to do that. But that's three times more expensive than it would be to buy a termly bus pass. So there is a real disconnect, even in Greater Manchester, between like commuter students and students who are living on.
This is the most important message that I can give to institutions, to local authorities, to transport authorities. I'm so excited by the B network. It's right up my street. But it's just so important to see students as they actually are. So in Canterbury, we do have the University on the Hill. We have Kent, and that their students are a certain kind of student, and that's great. Our students aren't that campus-based university. We need to get that message across. Our institution needs to accept that and provide for that, and local authorities do as well. So the most important thing is to see students as they are, and actually to count students as well, because only by counting students can you make them count. It's the only way that we can make local authorities, decision makers, service providers actually see, is by giving them a number, as well as the wonderful qualitative research that we're doing to reveal the student experience. Service providers listen to numbers, and where we can go to local authorities, to councils, to service providers or whoever, and we can say, this is the number of students that we have, this is the number of students who live in your city, then hopefully, and also a plea to the OFS, if they are here, I don't know, please have a single definition of commuter student, because then we're all counting the same thing, and then we can all measure progress and talk authoritatively to government about who our students are. If we're not measuring everybody the same, then we just can't hope to talk with our decision makers and service providers.
Absolutely. It strikes me that just talking there about kind of counting students, how little local authorities like know how many students are in that city, know where they live, know how they can access the GP. Like, universities could recruit another 20,000 students tomorrow in Kent or wherever, and there will not be the homes to house them, but the local authority doesn't know that. They don't know how many students come in. There's so much disconnect in terms of just sharing knowledge at the basis before you even get to service provision.
Absolutely. I work with local authorities and transport providers, and I was having a conversation with our sub-national transport body and in the southeast, and I said, do you know that there are 200,000 students in this area, all using your network, all using the roads, the buses, the trains? And I think they had the idea that students are on the campus, they go to a defined area, they don't actually use the network or the services, but we do. Students are using these networks and services. So all of the transport models, the healthcare models, that kind of thing, they're just not valid, because we're not seeing that 2/3 of our students in Canterbury live and stay. They don't migrate in and migrate out again. They're using the services just like a normal person would.
Our student stories continued throughout the day with a particularly eye-opening look at the nursing student experience from Paige Rivers, who's Health, Social Care and Medicine President at Edge Hill Students' Union.
I suffered a miscarriage during my studies, and instead of grieving, I could only manage one day off for the day I had surgery before I had to return to my placement to meet my nursing hours and to complete my exams. When my mum was ill with cancer, I couldn't support her as much as I wanted. If I did, it would have delayed my degree after years of fighting to become a nurse, and my mum didn't want that either, and she didn't want me to let the opportunity go again. I wanted to speak to people about the difficult things I saw on placement, seeing sudden deaths, traumatic deaths, and returning home afterwards was incredibly hard. I knew this would be part of the role, but as a student, I wanted support and understanding as I made that transition. I truly felt alone. So I started advocating for healthcare students who were struggling. For me, there are things that could make a difference. The loan forgiveness scheme, something that would have come after the degree, but would motivate nursing students who knew we would get something back after our commitment for 3 years. An apprentice level wage for our placement hours, more specialist support services available to us who understand what it is like to treat people in our line of work. We know that we cannot change the reality of working in healthcare, and I don't think we want it to change completely. What we do want is the support and recognition that as students, we do not often get a softer version of the NHS or a softer insight into what it is like. We are living in it and doing just as much work and feeling just as much pressure as those working full time. We work full time while being assessed on our performance and our competencies. Add on the assignments, the studying, the extra reading and activities to enhance our academic and professional outlook. We just want to be heard and for people to understand. I am a student nurse, and in 3 months' time, I would have completed over 2,300 working hours for free. In 3 months' time, I can process the past 3 years, appreciate the journey, but grieve what should have been, grieve the child that I lost, grieve the time that I did not get to support my mom when she needed me the most, grieve the experience and experiences I should have had in those pinnacle years of my life after years of not having a life due to being so unwell, grieve not being able to truly enjoy and make the most of my early adulthood. And in 3 months' time, I can finally be more than just a student nurse again. I can have an identity outside of my degree, enjoy the people I care about, and put energy into things I love the most. And in 3 months' time, I can finally feel like I'm free again.
Later in the day, we had a discussion about PGR students and the work that UKRI has been doing on its new deal. Here's Ewan Nicholas from UKRI.
Yeah, so around 2 years ago, we published, well, our response to the call for input and an action plan, which set out a variety of things that we were doing. And we're a funny sort of organisation, UKRI, because we have this structure with all different councils. So what we tried to do was identify areas where there was actually some really good work going on. And Research England in particular has a fund where they fund particular bits of work, they had some good projects, and there's no purpose in duplicating those and other bits. Also, the research councils were doing various bits themselves, and then our team looked at sort of where some of those gaps were. And what we'll do in the two-year review is look at all of that work and where it's progressed and where we need to go. So there's some big things that are happening. Around a couple of months ago in January, we published a review of our training grant conditions, which sets out the level of support that we provide universities, that universities then can translate into the support that they provide for their students. And one of the big things that we had heard from students was actually the level of support wasn't bright, particularly where things go wrong, and particularly, and there was a group called Pandemic PGR that I know you're part of as well, were particularly articulate about this to disabled students. So what we've really tried to do is to look at our role in that framework and what sort of support we need to put in place. And what the changes in January aim to do is to create a more flexible system for ROs, for universities, so that they then have more flexibility to support their own students. So that's great. That's a really big move. But those changes don't come into place until the 1st of October. There's 6 months to introduce them. If they affect you and you haven't looked at them, do sign up to our email list and our webinars on the UKRI website. The other big thing we've done, which was probably more immediate, was on stipends. So the stipend is the amount that is paid to PhD students. And I remember we got in the first responses and we were looking through them. And it was just at that point where the cost of living was really rising. And we went, oh, crikey, we need to look at this again. And I had a very vivid memory of the meeting where we took this along and that was decided. And there was a lot of work that happened after that, but we did eventually increase the minimum stipend. To make that happen, a lot of things needed to line up, but one of those was absolutely the voices that were in the call for input. Another was, so we were trying to act quickly, so we did a kind of light touch engagement with some universities, a kind of a range of different sizes across the country. You kind of get the idea. And some of those senior people who we were talking to had spoken to their own students in preparation, and they were able to give us, you know, a sense of what was happening on the ground. And even though that was quite an informal sort of process, was really useful in galvanizing the support. The upshot is we're increasing the stipend again this year. Since we held that call for input, I think, if I've got my sums right, I was sort of doing them backstage, the minimum stipend will have increased by a third in that period. Most of that's been obviously eaten away by inflation, but still this year we're making the first real terms increase in the minimum stipend for a long time.
Of course, realizing a new vision means letting go of how things used to be and finding new ways of thinking, doing and delivering. Darcy Jones, who's Education Officer at the University of Plymouth Students' Union, had thoughts.
I'm going to be a bit controversial and say I don't think universities truly see students as partners. They should be, but I think students are more seen by universities as they should be experts in higher education, which they're not. They're experts in being a student and what their lived experience is like, but we're putting pressure on students to be experts in higher education. And I think we're setting unrealistic expectations on students to know how to run a university. And there is a really tricky balance in either having no student voice or so much student voice that we're just expecting students to be experts, or actually it's a bit overwhelming. And sometimes, maybe again controversially, you don't need student voice on everything. Otherwise, it makes it difficult to run an institution. There is a tricky balance. And I'm not going to say I know what that balance is because I'd be lying to you. Yeah. So I think one of the other key things is that I do think that universities want to listen to students. And I think students do want to participate and be listened to. I just think the institutions at the moment aren't giving students the resources they need to truly be able to enact their voice in the right ways and in the right spaces. And a lot of that comes down to the fact that, as we said, all day students are time poor, but also yet again, students, whether that be your course reps, your school reps, or just passionate students that happen to have the opportunity to voice their own voice at certain opportunity, they are not trained to quite often be in political spaces, to be in these spaces that we prime our sabbatical officers to be in, and that people that have worked in higher education for however many years are used to. So in order, I think, to have students enact their voices in ways that are productive for you as a university, we first need to train our students on how to speak their voices and how to participate and how to also be members within your co-creation, and how students can actually be partners with you and not be experts in higher education. And with that does also come, we've said all day about students are time poor, students are financially quite poor. That does also mean that you are going to have to compensate your student representatives. I think a lot of the time in my conversations with students, even when they're in the room, they do feel a bit, not sure what the word I'm looking for is, a bit dismayed at the fact that students are expected to bring opinions and bring solutions and be really bold, in which they are, and they're really good at it. But when they are doing that, they're quite often the only person in the room that isn't being paid to be there. And I think that's really hard for students, and it makes it quite difficult for them to fully voice their opinions. So holistically, we need to create a space for students to feel confident, to feel like they have the right resources, to know that when you want a student to bring insight or an opinion, what does that actually mean? Does that mean data? Do you want actually, you want X amount of students to bring a general opinion, or do you want that one student lived opinion?
Then to wrap the day up, Jakob Blasius, who's the executive director of the Global Students Forum, set things into a global context.
And it's that kind of like, for him, he wasn't saying it because he was against students, but he hadn't experienced it. He hadn't seen that kind of power, that kind of energy, that kind of will that students have to take action and make changes now. And I keep thinking about the whole thing with the committees and how that thing where you have so much great potential and so much great energy in so many places that are just killed and drowned, really, and buried in bureaucracy and processes. And I've said a number of times to some of my colleagues who work in some of the international spaces where there's also many committees and places where you kind of like put aside a problem. If there's a space where there's nothing happen and it's clearly constructed for you to not have an impact, then leave that space. That's not a legitimate space for you to be in. And it is okay to be unreasonable as a student representative. It's okay to say the current format that we have that you have built for our engagement is not working and we don't want to be part of it. Right now, there's many student protests happening across the world. And I think for me, it's also about looking at how did we end up in those situations where students felt no other option than to walk out on the street and demand change. I'm thinking of course, the developments that happened last year in Bangladesh, where now you have a lot of the student movements being part of renegotiating how the government should be structured. You have the conversations happening in Iran, where students again and again and again walk out on the streets, even in a regime that's incredibly hostile towards their own participation. And just right now, you have the students in Serbia who are participating in these large-scale protests, walking out on the street, demanding new change. And I think it's really a consideration for us who live in countries that are more stable, that are more democratic, where we have that voice already, to think about how can we support them? How can we open up that space for other students to say that they can actually be part of helping other students, be part of that shared conversation about rights? Because we really, honestly, all of us in this together. So that would be my final call to action. I've really enjoyed listening to all the conversations you've had, and thank you so much for having me.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to keep ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the website and click subscriptions to find out more. So thanks to everyone who made it to The Secret Life of Students, our speakers, our sponsors, and our guests. The Wonky Show will return in its usual format after Easter. Until then, stay wonky.